Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the economy here in the United States and also the plan that members of Congress believe will jumpstart the economy once again and get it out of its slump. Back in October, the House, controlled by Republicans, passed a stimulus package that relied mostly on tax cuts to do the job, that is, tax cuts both for individuals and for businesses. The Senate, controlled by Democrats, they didn't like that package, and they said they were more interested in trying to do something for people who were out of work, and they wanted to extend the period for unemployment benefits. They also wanted to work out some way so that people who had lost their jobs could hold on to their health insurance. And there, the deadlock has stood for some time. Now, members of Congress are concerned because they're getting close to adjourning for the year and are trying to work something out. And the latest reports that I've seen suggest that maybe they think there's a way that they can actually have it all, have everything that they want, both tax cuts and benefits for people who are unemployed. This morning, we'll talk about all of this with Dean Baker. He's an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Before that, he was senior research fellow at the Preamble Center in Washington and the Century Fund in New York, and before that was a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. His writing has appeared in many publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, American Prospect. He has been interviewed on programs like The NewsHour on PBS, also NPR and other radio and TV shows. He's the co-author of several books, and one I just mentioned because it's also one of the issues that's on the table these days. This book is titled Social Security, The Phony Crisis, published by the University of Chicago Press in 1999. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, anyone who's listening is welcome to call. If you have questions, comments, the only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving and get in as many people as possible. Anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Baker, hello.
Yes, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
I'm interested, I guess, in your reaction to both the strategies that have been now put forward by the Republicans and the Democrats, and I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, but let me ask you first. The Republicans, what they initially started out talking about was providing tax breaks to corporations and also to individuals, and said that that was the way to stimulate the economy again. Do you believe that indeed that would have some positive effect on the economy?
Well, it would have some very, very limited positive effect. I think the Republican plan was extremely cynical. I mean, the Republicans basically have an approach that no matter what the problem is, the answer is tax breaks for wealthy people and corporations. And, you know, they really showed that with their stimulus package, because among the other items in there was a plan to have retroactive tax cuts. And, I mean, if you wanted to have anything that would prove the point, you could give an argument, and we could debate the point, you know, do we want to have tax cuts for corporations to give them incentive to invest more in the future? You know, it's an arguable issue. It has some effect. How much? That's what economists would debate. We can't change their behavior in the past. So when they say we want to have tax cuts retroactively, I mean, it's the same thing as if I just went there, why don't you give me money? That will help the economy. I mean, it's as serious as that. So, you know, that was the basic theme of their approach. Now, again, their tax cuts would have some positive effect on the economy. The point when you want to have stimulus is to increase demand any which way you can. If you give more money to corporations, well, some of that is going to be paid out as dividends. Some of that will be spent. It will have some positive impact on investment. It won't be zero. So it'll have some impact on the economy, just very, very little. So, you know, they're talking about roughly $100 billion in tax breaks. Well, some of that will help the economy. It's not the best way. It's not the most effective way, but, you know, it's not zero.
Mm-hmm. I guess here I have to say one of the points I'm a little bit confused about, because I've tried to look at what's happened, and the corporate tax breaks proved quite controversial. A lot of people attacked the Republicans and said, here, this is Republicans doing what Republicans do. They want to pass legislation that would benefit the wealthiest. And here we have corporations that sometimes pay little or no tax, and we're just giving them an even bigger break. Is that still on the table? I guess I thought that maybe they had said, all right, maybe we won't do that.
They're backed away a little bit. I mean, that was what passed the House. Now, there were two parts of that. The House bill had both the retroactive tax cuts, so they were eliminating this alternative minimum tax that ensured that, you know, profitable corporations would at least pay something. So to eliminate it going forward and also eliminate it retroactively back to 1986, that was the retroactive tax break. So firms would get refunded money that already paid in taxes. The Senate had wanted to have the elimination of the alternative minimum tax going forward, but was not, the Senate Republicans, I should say, but were not insisting on the retroactive tax break. Now, in negotiations, they've apparently, you know, this is, you know, what's been leaked, and I assume it to be correct, they've apparently agreed to give up their plans to get rid of the alternative tax altogether, the elimination of the alternative tax. So what they're asking for now by way of corporate tax breaks is accelerating the depreciation, allowing firms to write off investment more quickly. And again, now we're in a realm, you know, when you talk about that, you could say, okay, here's something we could debate. It's at least a serious proposal. You know, so in that sense, it is a step forward.
Mm. Another item that was discussed is providing a new round of tax rebate checks, like those that a lot of people received this summer and this fall. But this would be checks that would go to lower income people who had not gotten a rebate the first time around. And I guess I'm interested in, first of the question, that first round of checks, thus these hundreds of dollars that people received, what happened to that? What did people do with it? Did they save it? Did they spend it? Did that have any effect on the economy that you could see, and then whether you think then this additional bit of cash that they're talking about sending to people, would that indeed make any difference that we would see?
Yep. Well, the original rebates were on the order of $40 billion, and clearly most of it was saved. But, you know, even if you say just say a quarter of it was spent, you know, that would be $10 billion, and because we're talking over a fairly short period, you know, roughly 2.5 months, that'd be the same thing on an annual basis of, you know, about $50 billion in additional spending. So it's not trivial. I mean, it would have been nice. It would have been good for the economy, I should say, had people spent more at that point in time. Would have provided a greater stimulus. But people surely spent some of it, let's say 20, 25 cents on a dollar, which wasn't inconsequential in terms of where the economy was at the time. So it was a good measure. It didn't go far enough. It would have been better to see bigger rebates. I mean, again, we could think of other ways to stimulate the economy as well, but, you know, in terms of stimulating the economy, the bigger the rebate, the more it would have stimulated them. What we're talking about going forward is for lower-income wage earners that didn't pay $300 per person in income tax. They didn't get a full $300 rebate, and some people got zero. So the current proposal is to give them rebates based on money they've paid in payroll taxes, Social Security and Medicare taxes. So you'd have a lot of lower, more moderate income wage earners who would get $300 checks. Now, given the income brackets these people are in, there's probably a pretty good chance that they will go out and spend it, because, you know, a lot of these people are, you know, really just scraping by. So you give them $300, they probably will spend it, at least many of them. And again, given where the economy is now, that is what we want to do. I mean, stimulus isn't really complicated. You want people to spend money. That's what it means. And, you know, that's why, again, you know, I'll beat up on the Democrats plenty, but, you know, in terms of the Republicans, you can make an argument for tax cuts to wealthy people, and they have. They did. And the idea was they were going to save it. That was exactly, you know, when President Bush was proposing it. It was, you know, we're going to give money to wealthy people, and it's going to benefit everyone because they'll save it, and that saving will eventually lead to more investment, more jobs. Well, if he was telling the truth then it's not good stimulus, because you don't want to give money to people you expect to save it, at least not if the point is to stimulate the economy, because saving will not stimulate the economy. Spending is what stimulates the economy.
We're talking this morning with Dean Baker. He is an economist. He is also co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about the economic stimulus legislation that's being debated in the Congress. The House passed one kind of package. than that was mostly reflected the interests of the Democrats. The Republicans in the House. Then over in the Senate, that's where the controversy is, because there what they want to do reflects the interest of the Democrats that control that chamber. It looks like probably something's going to get worked out. I think the members of the Congress want to work something out before they leave Washington for the holiday recess. Questions, of course, welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, in interest of bipartisanship here, we'll give you an opportunity to say something critical about the Democrats. The Senate Democrats, what they say that they want to do is to do something for people who have lost their jobs. So what they want to see is an extension of the period for which a person can receive unemployment. They also wanted to do something that would make it possible for people who have lost their jobs to continue to have health care. Now, we can see that those things certainly would expect that they would benefit people who are out of work, but I'm not sure what that does for the economy at large.
Well, that will keep spending up. I mean, that is what you want to do. I mean, basically, when you're in a recession, you want to see spending of any stripe. So, that would be a step in the right direction. If I say my biggest criticism of the Democrats at this point is they're thinking too small. They're still in this box, they had, their lockbox, their campaign rhetoric, we have to pay down the debt, we have to save the Social Security surplus. This scored well in focus groups. It makes no economic sense. And, they continue to be, tied to their focus group economics. And, as a result, they'd rather just have a relatively small stimulus package. I think we need a very big one because, we're looking at a serious downturn. And, one area that I would look to do, again, the point of stimulus is to get people to spend money, an obvious way to do it. You have a lot of states, in fact, the vast majority of states, are facing serious budget shortfalls, and they have to make cutbacks. And that's a contractionary impact on the economy. So if you just had some revenue sharing, perhaps another $50, $60 billion in revenue sharing, that would make it unnecessary for state and local governments across the country to cut their budgets. And, if we could do that, that will help stimulate the economy. So, I think they're still thinking, just in way too small terms. They're locked into this, approach about saving the Social Security surplus, which, as I say, it was based on focus groups, not on economics.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that the pressure to get something done before the holiday recess is going to lead to them working something out? So, as I suggested, and that's suggested by the most recent stories I've read, they're going to try to work something out so that they can pass something, then they can go home, and what they pass will enable everybody to come away and say, well, we got what we wanted.
Well, if I had to place a bet, I'd say it's somewhat higher than 50-50. I would say that, they probably will pass something because, they're sitting there weighing what are the advantages of, blaming the other side versus, saying we did something. The Democrats, the Republicans did make a big political mistake, the House Republicans, in passing something that really was that blatant and coming right in the wake of September 11th. So less than a month after September 11th, they're passing a measure that gave, billions of dollars to the biggest corporations in the country. Ford, IBM, Enron was getting, millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars on this. So it looked really, really crude, and the Democrats were happy to exploit that as an issue, as a political issue. So they're weighing the advantages of trying to say, look, here's the Republican stimulus package. They just want to give money to the richest people of the country at a time when, the nation's at war. Whereas, the alternative, there is a recognition people are hurting, and you do want to be able to say you're going to do something. And, that is a powerful pull. So my guess is that they probably will try to find a compromise. So as I say, more likely than not, I think they will. But again, the Republicans will certainly have to give something, and they have moved some, but they certainly will have to give some significant ground for it to be worthwhile for the Democrats to meet them on it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Senate Democrats have been arguing for is some way to continue to provide health insurance to people who had been in employer-provided programs who now have lost their jobs. And there seems to be some debate between the Democrats and Republicans over how this gets worked out, because what it seems the Democrats want to do is as I said, to make sure that people who had health care through their jobs before continue to have health care. What the Republicans want to do is they want to have a tax rebate available to everybody, whether they had gotten health care through their employer or not. And some people are arguing that what this is, it's an attempt by the Republicans to build a case for to break the connection between the work and the health insurance.
Well, the Republicans have said that as much. Bill Thomas, the head of the Ways and Means Committee, has basically said that, you know, for him it's a philosophical issue. He doesn't believe in employer-provided health insurance, or, you know, doesn't think that's the best way to provide it. So it's not just an accusation. I mean, that's his view. He's been quite explicit. He doesn't want it to take the form of keeping people in the employer pools. You know, he'd rather be in the form of an individual tax credit. The very practical matter, and that, you know, if you're trying to say, you know, we're trying to make sure these people maintain coverage, insurance companies do not want to insure people that are unhealthy. This is the problem that anyone's ever looked at healthcare economics, you know, has to cope with. That, you know, if you're an insurance company, the best way to make money is you only insure healthy people. And if you have these people who have been in pools, let's say someone in their 40s, 50s, they're not in great health, they have, you know, whatever, some pre-existing conditions, they just go out into the market and just say, I want to get insurance. Well, we can give them a $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 credit. They won't be able to buy it. Or they could buy it by spending $10,000, $15,000, or $20,000, because the insurance company simply will not insure them, or at least not at, you know, a rate that's going to be affordable. So what the Democratic plan is intending to do is try and keep those pools intact so that, you know, most people obviously are in reasonably good health. They would be fine under the Republican proposal, but the ones who really need insurance, the ones that actually have problems, they, you know, the Republican tax credit isn't going to do them very much good.
If we talked a little bit, you talked a little bit earlier about the something that you think that they could do, that is, increase federal revenue sharing and give some more money back to the states. That, and the states, as we know here in the state of Illinois, other states are really hurting. They're experiencing budget shortfalls, and they're looking at cutting back on all sorts of services that the state provides to their citizens. That one thing that the federal government could do that would actually benefit the economy and would help the states out would be to give them some more money. So that's one thing that maybe would be more of an economic stimulus than what it is we have been talking about and members of Congress are talking about. Are there some other things that you would, you know, if we said to you, okay, what would be your economic stimulus plan? Some things that we could do, what would they be?
Well, in general, if you give money towards lower-income people, they're going to spend it because, you know, in general, they're living hand-to-mouth and they're not in a position to save. So, you know, the $300 tax rebate, you know, that proposal, that's a good one. If we're more broadly based, because even then, you're only giving it to working families. You have a lot of families that aren't working for whatever reason or didn't work the full year. So, you know, if you gave more money in that form, that would be a good step. You know, the health insurance proposal, I don't know if this is the best time to address it, but we do have to do something about our health care system. It's, you know, you mentioned my book, Social Security, the Phony Crisis. So one of the things that is very painful to me is we're arguing about the Social Security system that's basically sound, the problems that it faces, and, you know, this is what everyone in the debate recognizes. The problems it faces are relatively small. They're distant, you know, 30, 40 years out. They're no bigger than what we had in the problems we had in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. So, you know, they're not big problems. Healthcare costs are rising at the rate of 10, 12, 14% a year. You have more and more employers dropping people from their health insurance rolls, or they're shifting more and more their cost onto the workers, so many workers are finding it unaffordable. We do have to do something about the healthcare system, you know, and every year we put that off, it becomes harder and harder to deal with. So, you know, it may be a good time, and obviously it takes time. You know, we can't change the healthcare system tomorrow, and that is the point with stimulus. You do want to spend the money now. But, you know, if we want a way to spend money, certainly you could spend a lot in getting our healthcare system in order. Unfortunately, you probably would have to spend a lot.
Yeah. Maybe we could return to or continue here for just a second, although maybe it's a slightly different topic, but it's certainly related. That is Social Security and Social Security reform. It may not have gotten a lot of attention, but recently the commission came out with a recommendation going in the direction that I think the administration wanted to go, certainly, and that is giving people the option of taking some of that Social Security money and investing it. It's something that I know you and your partner have said you're not really sure that that's such a good thing, or at least maybe that's it doesn't need to be done, and there are additional risks and so forth. Do you think that indeed this direction that Republicans have been wanting to go in for some time, that that's the way we're going to go?
I think it's very unlikely at this point. You know, there were a lot of people that had illusions about the stock market in the 90s, you know, particularly the late 90s when the market rising 20% a year. People really are superstitious on the market. I mean, I find this really frustrating as an economist, particularly talking with other economists on the issue, because I expect them to be serious, and they're not. You know, but you had a lot of people that had illusions that, you know, the stock market was just going to go up, you know, 15-20% a year every year, you know, from, you know, now to eternity. And, you know, I suppose if I believed something like that, I'd probably say, sure, why don't we put every penny we could find in the market? You know, we'll all be rich. But that's not the real world. And, you know, what I've, you know, challenged every person in this debate, all the economists in the debate, I really, at this point, I just harass them. I abuse them because I think they're lying to people. You know, because I say, if you think the market will give the returns you're projecting, then write down the numbers because, you know, stocks just give you a return by either dividends or capital gains. And, you know, the thing about Social Security, the whole debate takes place in this context where we think we know the whole world 75 years out. We're making projections 75 years out for, you know, wage growth, life expectancy, birth rates, immigration rates, everything in the world. You know, that's the way the debate takes place. And I've told, you know, all these economists who support privatization, if you think this is the best way to go, write down your projections for stock returns. What are the dividend yields we'll get? What are the capital gains year by year, or averages? I mean, I don't care what it is, a specific year, but 10-year average over, you know, this 75-year period, and let's see if that makes sense. And no one could do it. And I just have fun with them. I actually, at one point, I said, here's $1,000. I'll give it your favorite charity if you could just put down the numbers. Not one person has. You know, and it's remarkable to me that they've, you know, just really tried to sucker the nation, just making up, in effect, lies about the sort of returns that people can get on the stock market, and that they'll be that much better off by investing in the stock market rather than Social Security. So, you know, not that I think that many people are aware that they're just being completely lied to by, you know, the proponents of privatization, but the fact that so many people have seen the market fall a lot in the last year and a half, and in many cases, unfortunately, have lost an awful lot of money that way, you know, I think people do have a different attitude towards the stock market. So even though, you know, we still have a lot of people trying to pawn off, you know, basically phony stories about how much money they can make, you know, I think people have really been shooken by the fall in the market, and you have a lot of people, particularly those in their late 50s who, you know, had a lot of money in 401ks and lost it, who are, you know, very happy that they have their Social Security benefit that they can turn to and count on.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, economist Dean Baker. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Before that, he was senior research fellow at the Preamble Center, also in Washington. He worked for the Century Fund in New York and was senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. He's written for a number of publications, or his writing has appeared in them, Atlantic Monthly, Washington Post, others. He's been interviewed on radio, television. He's the author of co-author of several books, including this one that I mentioned at the beginning, Social Security, The Phony Crisis, and was published by University of Chicago Press in 1999. More recently, he's the co-author of The Scorecard on Globalization, 20 Years of Diminished Progress. He's talking with us by telephone from Washington, and your questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I'm not sure when exactly that was, but this fall, economists concluded that not only were we in recession, that actually we'd been in recession for a while. And at the same time, though, now people are saying, well, maybe we're at the end of it, and we're poised for – we're at the lowest point, and we're poised to start going up again. What do you think about that, about where we are and about the direction that things are going?
Well, first off, I think most of the people are saying we're about to, you know, bounce out of the recession. All these were people that didn't see the recession coming on to begin with. So, you know, I think, you know, what they're saying has to be taken with, you know, a grain of salt here. I actually think we're looking at a pretty serious downturn, and the reason is that the causes of this recession are very different than prior recessions. Prior recessions, if you look back to, you know, the one in 1990, the one in the early 80s, mid-70s, basically all the post-war recessions were caused by the Federal Reserve Board raising interest rates with the idea of slowing the economy. And in each case, it turns out they went a little too far, and that pushed us into the recession. And in In this case, the Fed was raising interest rates in 99, 2000. That did play a role. But the real story here was the crash of the stock market, the collapse of the tech bubble. And, you know, what I mean by this, we had the telecoms, we had the dot-coms, we had a real investment boom based on the fact that we had companies that could just go out and issue stock and, you know, raise a fortune, you know, even though they weren't even making a profit, didn't know when they'd make a profit, but they could raise a fortune in the stock market that way, and then they were laying cable, they were setting up their dot-com companies. There was a huge burst of investment based on this. Well, that collapsed. That's collapsed over the last year and a half. So we've seen a big fall off in investment. And then on top of that, because we had this huge stock bubble, the stock market was way, way overvalued, we've had a, you know, at least a partial fallback of the market. I think it has a lot more to go. If you look at price-to-earnings ratios, it's still very, very high. But we had a partial fallback in the stock market, and that's going to lead to a very large fall-off in consumption. So if you put numbers on that, we've looked at a fall-off in investment of more than $100 billion a year. We're probably going to see a fall-off in consumption and perhaps the order of $200 billion a year. And then you just say, okay, well, what is going to replace that? You know, we've lost $200 billion consumption, $100 billion of investment. What do we see is going to replace that? And, you know, there's nothing you could really put your finger on that's just going to replace $300 billion of lost demand. So, you know, we could point to a few things where we've been relatively fortunate. We've had low interest rates. I give the Federal Reserve Board credit for lowering interest rates quickly. They didn't do that in 1990 and 91, but they did do it this time, and that was the right thing to do. That's helped the housing market. It's helped the auto market because it was easier for, you know, the big three to have their zero interest financing, which helped keep the economy going. But this, you know, we see the end of the zero interest financing. Interest rates on home mortgages have already started to go up again. I just don't see, you know, the basis for any sort of sustained recovery at this point. So I think a lot of people are kind of grasping at straws. You could look at a good number here or there. I know that we just had a good number on housing starts. You know, it's good news, it's better than a bad number. But it's just very hard to see the basis for real recovery at this point. I think we're looking at, you know, continuing rise in unemployment and probably, you know, quite a long and fairly steep recession.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more for a second here about the Fed. As you point out, they have been very aggressive in cutting interest rates. Last week, I believe it cut rates for the 11th time this year.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it really is remarkable because if we were having this conversation last year, the federal funds rate, the interest rate directly under their control at that time was 6.5%. It's currently 1.75%. And, you know, if we were having this discussion, I was trying to tell you, you know, this time, you know, 2001, you know, the interest rate was going to be under 2%. You know, you would have laughed at me. Anyone would have laughed at me. I wouldn't have believed it myself. You know, so they've been very, very aggressive in lowering interest rates. And as I say, it was the right thing to do, but it's, you know, and it has helped, you know, help keep the economy from sinking more than it otherwise would have.
But it seems though, in a way that the result has been rather modest compared with how dramatic the actions of the Fed have been.
Well, that's right. I mean, the interest rates have a limited impact. They're very good at stopping the economy. You know, so in other words, you know, when the Fed raises their interest rates, you know, as they did in 99, 2000, or, you know, if we go back to the last recession in 89 and 90, they raised their interest rates a lot, and it does put a real brake on the economy. But the opposite, when the economy is already headed down, lowering interest rates has a good effect. I mean, it's positive, but it can only do so much. And, you know, you say, okay, what's it going to affect? It does have an impact on housing. We saw, you know, both a lot, you know, pretty good housing sales through, you know, the summer and fall, and a lot of people refinancing their mortgages, you know, freeing up money for consumption. So, you know, those are good things. It helps with car loans. But from the standpoint of, say, business investment, it doesn't, you know, no one's, at this point, you know, you have huge overcapacity in just about every sector. So, you know, no one's going to run out and start laying, you know, another round of fiber optic cable or, you know, build another chip plant or whatever it might be when there's already, you know, a huge amount of excess capacity. Just because interest rates are low, you have to see the demand there. You have to see some basis as to why this investment would make sense. So, you know, interest rates, lower interest rates are good. It was the right thing to do, but, you know, it can only go so far.
After a period when in Washington they were rejoicing over budget surpluses. And I guess the idea that there was all of this extra money helped to justify and make the argument, helped Mr. Bush make that argument that that money ought to go back to the people who paid it into the government in the first place. Now, after all of that, it looks as if now both the administration and Congress is expecting that, at least for the next few years, we're going to be back to running budget deficits. And no doubt in next year being an election year, there's going to be a lot of argument about just who was responsible for just who lost the surplus. I'm sure that there'll be a lot of that going on. Indeed, is that where we are? Is the budget surplus now gone? And should we expect that we'll be running deficits again now for the foreseeable future?
I think that's right. We probably will be running deficits, you know, and there's other factors people haven't even begun to include. So, you know, one of the things that I had noticed and commented on in some of my writings in the past was that the Congressional Budget Office was assuming over $100 billion a year in capital gains tax revenue. And capital gains tax revenue these days comes almost exclusively from stock market gains. And, you know, you can get that when the stock market's, you know, going up, 10, 15% a year. You can't get when it's going down. So, you know, when they put more reasonable numbers there, we're going to be looking at even larger deficits than people have been talking about. But, you know, I think the whole debate over who lost the budget deficit, the focus groups, that's not my area, and, you know, maybe that's productive in the focus groups, but from an economic standpoint, it's really a silly debate. We don't have to run budget surpluses. There's no particular reason for us to be running budget surpluses. And it really gets us in a world where we have artificial constraints. I mean, you know, if there are things that we have to spend money on, you know, whether it's our education of our kids, healthcare, laying infrastructure, you know, if we have to rebuild our rails or, you know, airport security, I mean, we could think of lots of areas where, you know, in principle money could be used effectively. If we put that aside because we say we have to balance the budget or we have to run surpluses, it really is a very costly decision because, you know, these are all areas you pay a price for neglecting and you go, okay, well, after, you know, 10 years or whatever date it was, we were hoping to have the debt paid off. You know, maybe we have the debt paid off and go, so what? You know, okay, we've saved money on interest. But, you know, we don't think it was very peculiar if, you know, we saw a family that was neglecting the education of their kids or wasn't keeping up their house so they could put money in the savings account and get 3% a year interest on it. I mean, it just seemed a peculiar choice. And that's, in effect, what we were committing ourselves to do. And it was just, it was very, very strange. And, you know, it was based on focus group, but it wasn't based on economics.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Somebody on our toll-free line. It's line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
It seems to me that all through the 90s, the Clinton administration, the economists and the financial writers were proclaiming that Greenspan was the miracle worker, that the prosperity, so-called prosperity, was not due to Clinton. It was all Greenspan. Well, it seems to me that Greenspan is still there. Clinton is not. Now, I don't know whether that has anything to do with it or not, but it's been a rather amusing thing to me, the way the media were calling Greenspan the miracle worker all during Clinton's administration. Greenspan is still there. Now, I want to mention about this interest business. I'm an old person, and I'm not in the stock market. I don't dare take the risk. So what my investments are almost totally in government bonds and certificates of deposit. And my latest return on the certificates of deposit is an APY of 2.25%.
Yeah, low interest rates are a two-edged sword. I mean, you know, if you're a borrower, better or worse, more people are borrowers and lenders on this front. But, you know, obviously it's good news. But, you know, people in your situation, and there are many elderly people who are, you know, have a significant portion of their income coming from, you know, certificates of deposits, bank accounts, and as those rates fall, you know, under 2%, you know, it's a real big cut in their income. So, you know, that's right, it's a two-edged sword. There's no two ways about that. But the other point, you know, was it Greenspan, was it Clinton? Well, I'm happy to be bipartisan here. I'm going to blame both of them because the prosperity of the late 90s was to a very large extent an illusion. we had a huge stock market bubble, just like Japan did in the late 80s. And both of them, both President Clinton and Alan Greenspan, were completely irresponsible in not trying to do something to prevent the buildup of that bubble. I mean, in effect, we had on the order of $10 trillion. I mean, think of that, $10 trillion. That's equal to a full year's output. It's about $30,000 for every person in the country of bubble wealth, illusory wealth in the stock market. And neither Clinton nor Greenspan did anything about that because they're very happy to, you know, sort of smile and say these are good times. Well, you know, Clinton was lucky in the sense that he got to leave town before the crash. Greenspan's still sitting there.
Yes, I agree. I thought all the time during that period of time that they were paper profits and weren't real profits at all.
And the thing was, it was easy to see. I mean, I could say I had plenty of writings in the time, so I'm not looking back with, you know, 20/20 hindsight. I was writing this at the time, but it wasn't that, you know, I had such great insight. You could just say, you know, what would be a path of corporate profits that would make sense of these sorts of stock valuations, and they were unimaginable. No one would have said that. So it was easy to see that we had a very large stock market bubble, and, you know, at some point, I couldn't tell you the date it was going to collapse, but, you know, I knew it was going to. I didn't have my money there, I'll tell you that. I have a 401k, none of it was in the stock market, you know, but it was sure it was going to collapse, and the economy as a whole, we're going to pay a big price, we're going to have a very bad downturn because of it. And you have a lot of individuals. Again, I just think of the irony of the Social Security debate that we're arguing because, you know, somewhere 35 years in the future, we don't know exactly how we'll be able to pay all benefits. But here we are in 1999, 2000, with a lot of people with, you know, all their retirement money or a very large portion of it in the stock market, and any reasonable person could see it's about to collapse. So, you know, we had really misplaced priorities, you know, at that period.
Well, at least I didn't lose anything in the stock market, so I'm not gaining very much, but at least I didn't lose anything in the stock market. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. I'm sure that if I say this, some people would out there would start screaming, but I guess there would be those people, and perhaps these are the Wall Street types, who would make the argument that really what we've seen here is a correction. A violent and painful one, but that they have long-term faith in the market and that, in fact, the trend overall has continued to be upward movement, and that the kind of changes in the American economy that we've seen and go on and on with that are they're not going to turn around. That is, those changes, we're not going to go back, that things will get better again, that it's just a matter of time and that people should just hold on.
Well, again, what I always say to these people is just tell me, you know, as I was saying before with the Social Security projections, how much do you think profits will grow over the next decade? Or, you know, whatever time horizon you want. Do you want 15 years? Do you want 20 years? You know, pick your time horizon. I don't care. You know, pick the time horizon. Tell me how much they think profits will grow, and then, you know, we'll see whether the stock prices make sense. And the only way people can put down numbers that make sense, have profit growth that is way, way out of line with what the vast majority of economists, you know, think is plausible. And, you know, I'm saying this, you know, we have these projections all the time. So, you know, when we're talking about the budget debate, you know, we're looking out 10 years. Well, the Congressional Budget Office, the Office of Management and Budget, you know, they have projections for what profit growth will look like over the next decade. And it doesn't make sense. There's no way it makes sense of, you know, current stock prices, even with, you know, a drop of one-third. It certainly didn't make sense of the stock prices when they were at their peak in March of 2000. But even now, stocks are still hugely overvalued compared to projections of profit growth that the vast, vast majority of economists consider plausible. So what you really need is someone who's got a projection of profit growth that's just way out of line with, you know, the overwhelming majority of economists. Now, economists could be wrong, but I just think people should realize, you know, if you're putting your money in the stock market today, you're betting that the vast majority of economists are way off about the future.
We have as our guest this morning Dean Baker. He is an economist, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. We started out talking about the economic stimulus debate that's going on now in Congress, and also now we've moved to talking a little bit more generally about the economy. Your questions, comments are welcome. We have three people waiting. We have about 10 minutes left, so we'll get right back to callers. Next is, we'll take them in the order they came in, I think, and that should be line one here first. Hello.
A comment and a question. My comment is I really don't understand why when people recognize that the stock market is overvalued, well, then the nobody talks about that the game there then immediately becomes how do we get out selling our stock at this overvalued price? You know, and in other words, find the next sucker down the road. And it seemed to me that that's what really got the privatization of Social Security going. They figured that, hey, we've got, you know, this overvalued stock market. We get millions of people in line to buy this overvalued stock, and we can get out on top. That's my comment. I don't know if you want to intercede, but I got a question after that.
Okay, I think the main, if you look at the amounts of money that plausibly could go into the stock market, because it all doesn't go all at once, it go over a long period of time, it could not have really supported the overvaluation of the market. I think if you want to look for someone who stood to gain on that, the main story there is the financial intermediaries, you know, the insurance companies, the brokerage houses that would handle the accounts, because in principle they could get tens of billions of dollars a year in commissions and fees. So if you want to point to someone who stood to profit, I think that was how they would profit, by the fees they would charge us on the accounts.
Well, I'd have to look into that. That's kind of surprising to think that the bubble in the market wouldn't be able to be...
Well, to give you an idea of what we're talking about here, at its peak, the value of the market, all stock, was around $18 trillion. The amount of money that would have flown into the market plausibly under the various proposals that were being floated were probably 50, 60, 70 billion a year. So, you know, if you're trying to support a bubble on the order of 18 trillion with an inflow of 50, 60, 70 billion, it can't have that much impact. It has some. I won't say it's zero, but it's not going to support something that's so hugely overvalued.
Well, okay. Well, we could argue about that, but let me ask you this. You were talking about the 99-2000 increase in interest that Greenspan put out, and his reason for doing that supposedly was he wanted to stop inflation, and in his mind the key component was increases of wages and salaries. And it seems to me that he's always willing to savage those people relying on increases in salaries and wages, and that the whole globalization thing is a way to, just pick another victim here, and one without very much political clout. And you haven't talked about globalization, and what's happening on that front? What's the possibility that might be the way we end up?
Well, I'd love to actually talk about globalization, but let me talk first about the earlier issue you raised, because it's an incredibly important one. The Federal Reserve Board, and people should be fully aware of this, they basically put a floor on the unemployment rate. You know, that when I was saying earlier they raise interest rates to bring on a recession, well, I shouldn't say to bring on a recession, to slow the economy. Specifically, what they're trying to do is keep the unemployment rate from falling too much, because the concern, and I talk to these people, I mean, they, you know, they say this isn't a secret, it's in all the academic papers and stuff. Their concern is that at low unemployment rates, wages start rising more rapidly, and that will cause inflation. Now, prior to 1994, the almost universal view among economists, and certainly those at the Federal Reserve Board, was that the unemployment rate fell below 6%, that inflation would start to rise. And they were determined to keep that from happening. And if you go back to 1994, in February of 1994, Alan Greenspan began to raise interest rates. He raised them over the course of the year from 3% to 6% the following year, because he didn't want the unemployment rate to fall below 6%. And he did slow the economy a lot. What happened was the unemployment rate did fall a bit below 6%. It got to about 5.5, 5.4, and there was no inflation. And the one thing I'll give Greenspan credit for was that at that point he began to lower interest rates again, and he let the unemployment rate fall further. But then when it got to 4%, you know, you had all these people saying, well, this can't stay. That can't be. We can't allow 4% unemployment. Inflation is surely going to escalate. And, you know, you can always find some signs of that. So in 1999, they again began raising interest rates because they wanted to get the unemployment rate up at least a little bit from 4%, because they just thought this couldn't be sustained. But it's very important for people to understand the Federal Reserve Board really controls the unemployment rate. They control how many people in the country have jobs.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to try and get at least one more caller here, and we'll go to line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I Unfortunately, the previous caller answered several of my questions, but it did raise a few others. I haven't heard very many people talk about the dot-coms as using dot-coms and the stock market collapse using essentially the result of the fact that they were using sort of a Ponzi finance scheme in order to support their activities. In terms of the relationship between the stock market collapse and the collapse of purchasing, I wonder what you would think about that. Also, more generally, you had some strong language earlier. You were saying that some of the economists involved in privatization of Social Security were essentially lying. You said lying several times. I'd be curious to know what your what you believe the motive to be for these people to be lying. Why would they? What else would they be trying to do? What is their other motive? And we've not talked very much about the capacity, global capacity. I wonder, in terms of ending this recession or seeing an end to this recession, what is happening to capacity in the U.S. economy? Do we have a lot of excess capacity? And is, because of the period of globalization, should we be worrying now about global capacity and the slowdown in other economies and the existence of capacity, excess capacity on a global market?
Well, you gave me a really full plate. Let me just,
and we only got about that. Yeah, and I'm sorry, we only got about 2 minutes, too.
Oh, well. Okay, well, I'll answer that and just say yes. You know, it is a big problem. Our capacity utilization rate is about 75%. It's just about the lowest. We're approaching the low points of the 81-82 recession, a very severe recession. But getting to the other point about saying that people were lying on this, I'm saying this, I mean, I don't like to say people are lying, but the way economists work, and, you know, it's really frustrating to me because with the Social Security Trustees Report, you could look in there and you have very detailed projections for, you know, all these other things, wage growth, life expectancy, birth rates, immigration rates, and all these things are discussed in great, very great detail. So what I've said to these economists that, you know, if you support privatization, you support putting money in the stock market, well, let's just have the same sorts of projections, which, you know, no one's given me an argument as to why you would not do that for the stock market. So, you know, we all went to the same sorts of grad schools. I think we all do the same sorts of economics. And when I have these people that just refuse to write down the numbers, the only thing I conclude is they won't write down the numbers because in their experimenting with it, and I've talked to them enough, I'm sure a few have done the same sort of experiments that I've actually have written down the numbers, and they realize they can't make sense of the numbers that they're going out and telling the public. So they're telling the public numbers that they know they can't support. And again, I don't like to call people liars, but I don't know what else you could say about that. You know, the truth is that they're making claims about stock returns that simply are not plausible.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, and we have somebody else we can't take. We're just at the end of the time, I'm sure, though, in future, in different ways, we'll try to get back to some of these issues. But for the moment, we want to say thanks very much, Mr. Baker, for talking with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Our guest, Dean Baker, he is an economist and co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C.